actually, as soon as they leave work, are dealing with the horrors of reality of living under, you know, living in a situation where they're getting worse benefits, worse pay,
right,
and not even stable work schedules or anything like that.
$1,000. I mean, when you just hear $1,000, it sounds like so much money. But in, right, in terms of a work year, if we're talking about a bonus over the course of an entire year, if you're working 40 hours a week, $1,000 bonus is a 50-cent raise, basically.
And especially if you consider how much, you know, this tax plan, how much that is going to provide and benefit to Disney as the corporation. $1,000 to, yes, all of their, you know, their 40,000 or whatever, 80,000 workers at these resorts is chump change for them. And for them to highlight this, as many other companies have done, like, look at us, we are using this immediately, this tax break, and we're immediately benefiting workers. And then they're giving a one-time $1,000 bonus to those workers. That's their payout,
right,
for basically allowing them to just reap so many benefits from this new tax plan.
And one of the common criticisms of this is that, oh, this job is for high school kids,
right,
so they, you know, this isn't meant to be a living wage, which I reject anyways. I think as has been said, that any company that makes its money by paying people less than a living wage doesn't deserve to exist. And so I agree with that. But the statistic is that 70% of workers at the Anaheim Resort are 30 years and older.
Yeah, it's the same thing that we saw, you know, when the fight.
Yeah, yeah.
When the fight for raising the minimum wage came about, the arguments against it were, well, you know, minimum wage jobs are really just for entry level jobs for high school kids.
Right.
And that was not that wasn't borne out in the actual numbers of people working,
correct,
on those jobs. The same thing is true here. You know, it's 30 and over is the majority of the workers who are receiving these benefits or who are receiving
benefiting
these jobs
from it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
and it's just bad news. And I just want to pull one quote out and then we'll leave.
It.
But one of the workers was quoted as saying, "How are we supposed to make magic when we can't even afford to live?" And I think that sums the whole thing up.
That hits the nail on the head right
yes,
there.
Yes, indeed.
Well, it looks like we've actually gone a minute over, so we're all out of time.
we'll apologize the next show.
Do stay tuned for Prison Pipeline. That's coming
yes,
up
indeed.
Next. And so thanks for listening. We'll get you next month. I'm Nick Bubb.
And I'm Michael Cathcart. Have a great night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. Coming to you from the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. The reasons that women intersect with the criminal justice system are not always the same as those for men. Women may be more likely to have experienced intimate partner violence, sexual abuse, and/or other forms of abuse. Problematic substance use may be linked to past traumatic experiences and can play a role in offending behavior such as small-scale drug selling, prostitution, or property crime. Women are still a minority of Oregon's prison inmates, yet their numbers are growing rapidly. According to the Oregon Justice Resource Center, the population of women incarcerated in Oregon grew by 35% between 2005 and 2015. The number of men incarcerated grew by only 13% over the same period. Nearly 1,300 women were in prison in Oregon in March 2017. The Oregon Justice Resource Center is a Portland-based nonprofit that works to promote civil rights and provide legal services to communities that have often been underserved in the past. the OJRC created the Women's Justice Project to explore the issues around the involvement of women in the criminal justice system. I spoke recently with Julia Yoshimoto, attorney and project director for the Oregon Justice Resource Center, to learn more.
My name is Julia Yoshimoto, and I'm the attorney and project director for the Oregon Justice Resource Center's Women's Justice Project.
Julia, what is the Women's Justice Project?
The Women's Justice Project is the only project of its kind in the state of Oregon that's focused on advocating for a more gender-responsive criminal justice system. We know that most of the efforts around criminal justice reform and advocacy is based on men's experiences in the criminal justice system, and the Women's Justice Project is here to lift up the voices and experiences of women in the criminal justice system. The bulk of what I do is provide legal services to women incarcerated in Coffee Creek Correctional Facility that is focused around reentry legal issues. And in doing that work, I hear from the women about how they experienced the criminal justice system. And I hear about a lot of injustices or different experiences that they may be having than men in the criminal justice system. And organizationally, we look to increase public education around those issues. Women are predominantly incarcerated for drug and property offenses. There's a lower percentage of women that are incarcerated for violent offenses. Many of the women who are incarcerated are mothers and primary caregivers of minor children, and that impacts their experience in the system and their experience during incarceration. Many of the women that I work with have domestic violence or trauma in their history, and that is related to the criminal activity that led to their conviction. So once women are incarcerated, there are very limited number of spaces for treatment in prison. The mandatory minimum sentencing schemes in Oregon don't allow for alternatives to incarceration. So under Measure 11, if you're sentenced under Measure 11, alternatives to that prison sentences are not available. Women, because of their repeat property offender statute, women are often sentenced under that sentencing scheme where alternatives to the presumptive sentence is not available.
Talk to me about the Her Story Oregon project.
The Her Story Oregon project is something that the Women's Justice Project created or came up with in the last year and a half or so. And it was based on the stories that I was hearing from the women that I was working with at the women's prison. And when they would talk to me about what occurred for them in the criminal justice system, whether those were incidents with law enforcement at arrest, incidents with thinking about what's going to happen with their kids when they're deciding on a plea agreement, instances that they, altercations or confrontations that they might have had with corrections officers, all of these stories seem to raise complexities in somebody's criminal cases, experiences in the criminal justice system that are just not well understood in the community and that you can't get from just the data alone. And so the idea behind the Her Story Oregon project was to start putting out these stories so that people can see the complexities of the situations that people are in before the crime is committed, or so that they can put some face and a story and an understanding of person's situation to the data that they're seeing on women in the system.
How do you find the people for this? That would have to, I would think that would be a tricky thing because there'd be fear of retribution. Even if they're no longer in prison, I'd think they'd be scared.
So the stories that we have been able to record, most of them are from a story booth that we had at one of our annual Women in Prison conferences, where formerly incarcerated women signed up to be interviewed by our communications director, Alice Lundell, about their experiences in the criminal justice system. We also do include a couple of stories that we've collected from women who are incarcerated at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. And it's amazing to me how many women who are incarcerated at Coffee Creek want to share their story, and they want to get what their experiences are out into the community. And they do it from a place not to serve themselves or not because they think it's going to have any impact on their sentence or on their time, but they do it because they think that if the community hears about the injustice that they experience, that that will help to make change for a more just system, a fairer system. And so there are a number of women that I have met in Coffee Creek Correctional Facility that really want to share their story. For us, with the Her Story program, we have to be very conscious of the stories that we're collecting. We have to really talk to the women and be aware of negative consequences that could come from them sharing that they might not even be thinking about. And we'll talk to them about it. And if they still want to move forward with sharing their story, then we try to find ways for them to do that. It does become more challenging for the women who are recently released from prison. It's been harder for us to collect those stories because I think the impact of now being out in the community, the numerous responsibilities and requirements that they have to fulfill can make it challenging. So one, I think it's a time, their ability to sort of sit and think and have the time to share their story. And then I think the consequences and the realities of having their story out in the community just becomes more real for them.
Do any of them find it cathartic at all? I mean, does it help? Does it, like, I mean, I imagine there's a lot of the PTSD from coming out of there has gotten to be just.
A lot of what I hear from the women is that it was like a very nice feeling for them to be able to share. When they're incarcerated, they feel like they have no voice, that nobody's listening. They feel that people out in the community have forgotten about them. And when someone is taking the time to collect their story, to listen and to share, it reminds them that they matter, that people are thinking about them, and that they can find a way with their experience to make a difference in the bigger system.
That was Julia Yoshimoto, an attorney and project director at the Oregon Justice Resource Center. We were speaking about the OJRC's Women's Justice Project and the Her Story Oregon Project. We'll have more in just a moment. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's hear some short clips from the Her Story Oregon Project. First, here's Angel Bean.
He woke me up, and he's like, "Mom, the cops are surrounding the house." And I was, oh, wow, you know, frantic. And before I even noticed, he was headed for the door to see what they wanted. Why are they here? And I couldn't catch him fast enough. And of course, with the gang task force and all that, they have that procedure of, you know, hands behind your back, turn around. He had to go down the steps. He had to get on his knees. And I got to see all that through the living room window. And I remember just, oh my God, that's my son. And they're here to get me. I knew exactly why they were there. I did. And it was like, oh my gosh, that's my kid out there being treated just like the rest of us. And that was the aha moment. I had to do something different. I knew that I would need treatment. It wasn't the first time that I've had problems with the law or problems with my children being taken away. I knew that I had to do something different. You know, I knew that I didn't want this for my children. It was hard because I knew, oh my gosh, it's a violent crime. I'm so done. You know, I'm gonna be away for a little while. I was going to NAAA meetings in county. You know, it was a chance to get out of my 22-hour lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I had to start, you know. Yeah, the depression had probably set in, you know. Oh my gosh, there's no light at the end of the tunnel. I'm never going to get my kids. But then it became a motivation too. get yourself out of the funk, you know. But it's hard when there was no programs, really. Yeah, I could start doing the meetings, but in county, there's nothing, especially if you're in a 22-hour lockdown. You know, I knew that I wanted to change, but how do you do that change in county?
Now, this is April Scoggins.
When I first went into drug treatment, it wasn't because I wanted to stop using drugs. It was because, well, the first time was because I wanted to avoid prison time. And that didn't work for the judge. The judge still sentenced me to prison. So while I was incarcerated, I went through drug treatment again. And again, it wasn't because of something that I wanted to do. It was something that I knew was a requirement in order for me to see my children. So I completed treatment inside. By the time I was released and I completed a treatment outside, that time, I believe it was for me. There's underlying reasons why someone chooses to use alcohol and drugs. And I was using alcohol and drugs to deal with trauma that I had experienced rather than deal with them clean and sober. And I really didn't have the skills and the tools in order to do that. Drug addicts commit crimes to feed their drug habit. But really the issue is the drug abuse. So I don't think that putting somebody in prison or locking them up in jail or prison is solving the problem.
Here's Peyton Vernon.
Prison did not provide me with a safe environment or did not make me feel protected. I mean, it was my first time there, obviously, and I was still on intake when a sergeant listened to a video visit that I had where, you know, there were some sexual things said, and then I was very upset that day because they had done a search in my bunk. I mean, I was still coming off a lot of drug use, and so I was insane, and I hadn't gotten back to a clear state of mind, and so I, you know, was cursing and saying, I didn't say anything threatening or violent at all. Anyways, the sergeant listened to this, and she called me in. Well, I was informed that I was going to be getting, it's a violation where they drop your level. They take you to SEG usually. So I was informed that that was happening. This cop comes up and just gives me this piece of paper. I didn't know what was going on, but all these girls started gathering around. They're real interested. And he told me that the sergeant was going to speak with me that night anyways. She proceeded to take me in her office with another cop and just berated me. It was like a replay from what I experienced in the program. It was the same thing. And and she actually brought up, she somehow knew about that I had been in that program. And she said, well, I read something in your file about, you know, you get really freaked out when we take out the rubber gloves. And I was like, yeah, I do. I was in a program where I was abused. And she said, well, I don't believe that. And it was, you know, so that gives you an idea of what that conversation was like. But what it did was, it almost immediately after being in prison for 2 weeks instilled a deep-seated resentment, lack of trust, and anger towards the COs. And that's what I'm trying to say. So no, I didn't, prison was not a safe or protective environment for dealing with any of that. If anything, it re-aggravated.
Finally, here's Isabel Hartshorn.
It's been a nightmare. I've been homeless prior to my incarceration and homeless for many years. And my biggest thing was thinking, if I could only get enough money up enough to be able to have myself a little space, my own home, my own, it could have been a closet, just as long as I could put there were four walls and a door, you know, and I could call it my own. If I had enough money just to have something like that, then everything would be okay. So I've been blessed that when I got out, I got engaged with some different places, some different agencies, and I was able to get a grant. And that grant is that money that I've been hoping that I would be able to have to be able to have that housing. But that was not the stop of the barriers. There's barriers because once I've sent out so many applications and paid application fee after application fee, and just to be turned down because of my criminal record. I don't think that there's gonna be much success if you don't have stabilization, if you don't have a stable home, to be able to get up for work, to shower for work, to be able to take care of your needs. So, and there's not too many landlords that wanna hire to someone that has a criminal record.
You just heard Isabel Hartshorn, Peyton Vernon, April Scoggins, and Angel Bean. Their stories are part of Her Story Oregon, a project of the Oregon Justice Resource Center's Women's Justice Project. Alice Lundell is Director of Communications for the Oregon Justice Resource Center. I spoke with her about Her Story Oregon. You did a lot of the recordings. You got a lot of the stories from these women. Tell me some of the, what are some of the recurring themes that you hear from these women?
Well, what's been interesting recording these stories is it really has borne out some of the trends or the tendencies that Julia's talked about, that so much of the situations that women end up in that make them become just as involved started many, many years earlier. They started in childhood or they started in adolescence. You know, women have talked to me about growing up with parents who were abusive or had addiction issues or were just simply not very involved, were neglectful and not around a lot. And then maybe in the teens, women may have, you know, started to make the wrong kinds of friends, got involved with the wrong kinds of activities and kind of went off the rails. I mean, some of the stories talk about drug use at really quite shockingly young ages. So you can really see how some women have been on a path towards Coffee Creek many, many years before they ever set foot in the place. So that for me, I think, is a real sign that as a society, we really have to get back to the root causes all the time. That there are children right now in Oregon who are in those same situations. And if we don't do something about it in 10 years or 20 years, they are going to be the women that are at Coffee Creek or maybe another prison in the future. I think also that the big difference for me in the stories is to do with how long somebody has been out of prison. So some of the women that we have spoken to have been out of prison for maybe 15 years, and some of them have come out far more recently. And there are big differences between how much someone's been able to achieve post-prison in terms of establishing a life for themselves or even how they look at that experience of prison, because when it's some years in the past, you can maybe be more reflective on it, you have a little distance from it, maybe you are feeling safer and more secure and able to talk about it without it affecting you emotionally quite as much. Where a couple of the women I can think of that I've spoken to who are much more recently released at the point when I spoke to them were obviously still very much in the experience. You know, they were still quite vividly reliving what had happened to them in prison when they talked to me about it. And it wasn't just an event from their past. It was something that's still very present in their life. Many of the women talked about the challenges post-release. You know, you come out of the prison, but the experience really hasn't ended because now you have that conviction, you know, that black mark on your name, and yet you still have to find somebody to provide you with housing, and you have to find employment, and you have to get your community to accept you back. And that's very difficult to do when you have now a criminal history, and when people find out that you went to prison, you know, it's difficult to get many people to trust you and to welcome you back into the community.
That actually leads to how do you find the women to do this, and how do you get them to trust you enough to open up?
Well, women have come to us from a few different ways. Some of them are women that Julia has known through the work that she's done at Coffee Creek, and just, you know, from organizations that we're connected with, that we've partnered with, who may have suggested people. Some women who've had experience in the criminal justice system later turn that into a way of helping others. So maybe they become, maybe they go into working to help people find employment opportunities or become like a peer support to people. So some of those women who maybe have, as I spoke about, come to a little more of a place of distance from their prison experience and perhaps find it easier to talk. And then through events like our Women in Prison Conference, which takes place in the fall each year, that's an opportunity where women maybe come forward and say that they want to do this. So it's a range of ways that people might come to us, yeah. In terms of building a rapport or making somebody feel comfortable, we do look carefully at their situation. We consider maybe even legal implications that there could be for them in participating if there's still any kind of active case against them. We encourage them to think carefully about who might potentially see this. Would there be an impact potentially on their children or other family members who might be upset or suffer repercussions from them putting the story out there in this way? But in my experience, once women have come forward, it's because they've already started to think about those issues and they feel like the benefits of speaking out outweigh any possible disadvantages.
The two big questions are where do people go to find to see these, to hear these stories and to see these videos? And the other question is, how do people find you if they have stories that they need to tell?
Right. So we set up a website specifically dedicated to Her Story Oregon. And the address is pretty simple. It's herstoryoregon.org. So if you Google that or you just put that that address into the search bar, then you should be able to find that fairly easily. And on the website, we've been over time publishing the videos, but also we've had, for example, recently a blogger who is a woman that was incarcerated at Coffee Creek who's been monthly publishing her story there. So we've got a range of content on there and we're continuing to add more to it. So if you visit the herstoryoregon.org website, you can find the content there. There's also information for contacting us there, but probably the easiest way for people to get in touch is either to call our offices. So the Oregon Justice Resource Center phone number is 503-944-2270. Or the other way that you could get in touch is to probably email me, would be one option. So it's Alice Lundell, which is A Lundell, A-L-U-N-D-E-L-L, at ojrc.info. So either of those routes would be a way to find us, but we're, as an organization, the Oregon Justice Resource Center is active on social media, so you can find us on all those platforms as well. So there's a lot of ways that you can get in touch with us. And we do have, a careful process of talking to anyone who's considering participating before we go ahead and really help people to think about possible consequences so that they feel comfortable with their decision when they decide to record an interview.
Closing thoughts?
I think our hope for this project is to make what's going on in Oregon's criminal justice system come alive for people, because you can hear statistics like the fact that the number of women in Oregon's prison has tripled in 20 years. And that sounds dramatic, but you don't really have a sense of what that means until you hear somebody talk about their own experience of incarceration. So I think the stories make this real, they make it feel human, they give you a sense of connection to someone whose life experience may be very, very different. I mean, most of us will not experience incarceration, but a surprisingly large number of Oregonians will. So it's important for us all to understand what kind of an impact the justice system, for which we all as a community are responsible, is having on individuals and families in Oregon.
That was Alice Lundell, Director of Communication for the Oregon Justice Resource Center. I spoke with her and with Julia Yoshimoto, an attorney with the OJRC and project director of their Women's Justice Project. We were talking about the Her Story Oregon Project, an effort to deepen and broaden the conversation about whom we are incarcerating and why, by sharing the stories of women who are currently or were formerly incarcerated in Oregon. You can find out more about the Her Story Oregon Project at herstoryoregon.org. The Oregon Justice Resource Center is on the web at ojrc.info. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Prison Pipeline. You can find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline at the KBOO website, kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like and share it with friends. I want to thank my guests, Julia Yoshimoto and Alice Lundell, with the Oregon Justice Resource Center and the Her Story Oregon Project. A heartfelt thank you to our engineers, Danielle Parks and Mike Fataklis. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for joining us. You make it all worth it. I'm Doug McClay.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
You are about to cross the border.
Coming up on A Different Nature, it's a preview of this year's March Music Moderne, profiling three free concerts happening at the Community Music Center. Tombeau de Claude Debussy commemorates the passing 100 years ago this month of one of the 20th century's most influential composers. I'm Andy Hosh. Join me along with March Music Moderne's Bob Priest and composers Jeff Winslow and Jennifer Wright on A Different Nature, Monday, March 19th from 8 to 10 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.